I think we'll start the meeting, and we're going to start out today with a presentation on supportive housing and a managed care pilot. And so, Ms. Ho, if you want to start out. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jennifer Ho. I'm the Executive Director of Price Connection, and thank you for the opportunity to present research results on the Supportive Housing and Managed Care Pilot. Between 2000 and 2007, we invested $10 million in this pilot to see if we could break the cycle of homelessness for people with mental illness, chemical dependency, and chronic health conditions. In return, we raised $5 million in private funds from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and others to pay for the cost of operating a demonstration project. We hired an independent researcher, the Boston-based National Center on Family Homelessness. They studied the pilot's impact on participants and on government spending. This is one of the most comprehensive evaluations of supported housing in the country. It costs the state $4.3 million per year for 748 men, women, and children who are homeless. Not on the solution to homelessness, but on the cycle of homelessness in which people were trapped prior to the pilot. The research finds that the pilot housed people with long histories of homelessness, they improved their lives, scarce public resources were used more productively. We're here today to tell this amazing story. You have the report in your materials. The pilot served participants in Bloor's and Ramsey counties, including 157 families with 412 children and 135 single adults. Through lengthy in-person interviews, the researcher paints a picture of who we enrolled. People have been homeless for a very long time, 2 years on average for families and over 7 years for single adults. Participants had a lot going on in terms of mental illness, chemical dependency, disabling medical conditions, and histories of trauma and violence. Every participant that I've met has a compelling story. I asked Jim McCree to join me today to share his story with you.
Mr. McCree, and I'm just going to bring the meeting to order. We have a quorum. Okay, Mr. McCree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good afternoon. My name is Jim McCree. I appreciate this opportunity to share my experience with Heart Connection Supportive Housing and Managed Care Pilot. My story of not having consistent or stable housing starts the first time I ran away from home. I was 6 years old. My stepfather physically abused me. My mom was an alcoholic and suffered from depression. Even though I knew that she loved me, she didn't have it in her to protect me from her husband's abuse. The one or two times she tried, he would lay into her and I would jump to her defense. I was bounced from institution to institution when I was young. I would go back home between placements, but nothing changed. With the record of institutionalization, I was labeled with having an authority problem. Psychologically tested, and spent weeks in seclusion as a child. I was 13 the last time I was home with my family. I started experimenting with drugs when I was 7 years old. At 17, they gave up on institutionalizing me. As an adult, my homelessness was spent mostly outdoors, camping, and a few times in shelters. In my 20s and 30s, within a period of 8 years, I was stabbed a total of 19 times and shot twice. In 1998, I wound up at a mental health/chemical dependency treatment center. I was diagnosed with antisocial, borderline, manic depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder by having a violent home life from what I had seen on the street. I've been with Delancey Street team, part of the pilot, since March of 2003. I had never had an apartment by myself until I started working with them. While I had jobs off and on since I was 17, I could never keep them. My mental health barriers would cause so much anxiety I would lose my job because of absences and tardiness. I now have a psychiatrist and a nurse practitioner, and I'm on medication so that my disorder isn't as bad and my drinking has gotten a lot better. But being in public and functioning out of my home is still really hard. I would likely have died without Delancey Street. I was on a downward spiral in my life when I met them. I would probably have been drinking so heavily that I would have frozen outside. I definitely know I wouldn't have made it this far. Delancey Street is not like any other program or anything else that has ever tried to help me. The reason why I work with them is that they have never forced me to do anything. They give me suggestions and ask my opinion. We'll try different options and see how things go. They treat me and talk to me like a partner. My life has improved a lot since I've been with them. They help me get my apartment and furniture, and they help me learn how to budget my money, get a bus card, and get to appointments. They're responsible for where I am today. I was in rough shape with my drinking and living outside when they found me. The Delancey Street gave me hope, and it's genuine. They do care about what happens to me. This helps me care about myself, and it helps me with self-determination. I want to add that the bottom line is that the Delancey Street isn't about rigid enforcement. They're about support. As I wrap up, I want to emphasize that it used to be pretty hard for me to be in front of people like you today. In the past, I didn't like to go out, and it was hard for me to be in front of people. But I've been volunteering with Guild Incorporated to talk about my experience and educate people quite a lot in the past years. I do it because I want to give back. And if a few minutes of my feeling uncomfortable can help other people get housing and the services that they need, it's well worth it. And after this is all done, I'm very glad that I'm able to give back and that this is a feeling that makes me willing to keep doing this. Thank you very much for your time and your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Mr. Chair, if I may continue. Jim's supportive housing came from a mobile team. The pilot's intervention was done by 5 teams, 2 out of Bloor's County Human Services, and 3 in St. Paul. Mental Health Resources and Guild Incorporated work with single adults, and the Wilder Foundation works with families. We used a housing-first strategy that asserts that instead of requiring people to be stable in order to qualify for housing, we put people in housing so that they can become healthy. The intervention is intensive, client-centered, and flexible. We stick with people through bad times and good. I asked Julie Shannon, who leads the Wilder Project Quest team, to talk to you about how these services work with families.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Julie Shannon, and I work for the Wilder Foundation Project Quest. Have you ever had people expect that you knew how to do something, but you didn't? And you didn't have what you needed to do it? Have you ever felt so overwhelmed that you didn't know where to start? Have you ever felt so discouraged that you felt you had nothing to offer? These questions are part of an answer to another question that comes to my mind at different times working with families with long histories of homelessness. And I'm guessing it comes to yours as well. That question is, why don't they just? Why don't they just get a job? Why don't they just pay their rent? Why don't they just make their kids go to school? When I find myself thinking, why don't they just, I try to change the question. I change it to, what can be changed about the situation that might make change more realistic? And what can we do to provide support that might make a difference? Here is a family we've been working with on Project Quest for over 2 years. When they started the program, their 4-year-old daughter had spent each one of her birthdays in a homeless shelter. Before we could house them, the mom needed to take care of an old warrant, which meant spending a couple of weeks in the workhouse. 1 month passed, she hadn't followed up. 2 months passed, nothing. 3 months passed, still no follow through. Why doesn't she just? We stuck with her, we kept supporting her, we didn't stop. I remember the day she turned herself in. Then I understood how big of a step it was for her. Our staff saw the family every day until they were reunited. We began to look for a place for the family to live. Once the family was in housing, it was time to build on the trust they had developed. Their case manager visited faithfully, and an educational advocate worked with the children on school success. We connected them to an employment program, helped them find community resources, and paid for a dance class for the 4-year-old. But things did not change right away. They didn't pay their rent. The children were not getting to school every day. They didn't always keep appointments or attend Project Quest programs. Their landlord would not evict them for not paying rent because he got most of the rent paid by the subsidy. I felt so frustrated. Why don't they just? We stuck with them. We kept supporting them. We didn't stop. Then, another big step. Mom went to treatment. She attended school conferences for her 14-year-old for the very first time. She is a regular at groups and events. She volunteers and is looking for a job. I saw her the other day, and she proudly told me she has 10 months sobriety. I asked her if I could tell her story, and she told me without Project Quest, the family would still be homeless. That Project Quest did something different for her and her family. 4 years in and out of homeless shelters reinforced living in survival mode. No time, no energy, no support to make changes. Then there was a program that didn't go away when they missed the first deadline. They didn't have to start over again and again and again. The housing was there so they could get started. The program could offer different things to the family at different times. Help with transportation, health care, parenting, and a celebration when mom graduated from treatment. Why don't they just have many complicated answers? Our response sometimes is to change guidelines and impose consequences. That may bring some change, but real change comes when people have the confidence, the support, and the resources to do something different. Thank you for your time and your support to do this work. We have the honor of working with families to change the question from, why don't they just, to, what next?
Thank you, Julie. Mr. Chair, if I continue, the researchers note that the ability of staff to develop trusting relationships with participants is the linchpin of effective services. The work you and other service staff do is hard, but has accomplished much. I'd like to go through some charts and graphs, I hope that you can see up here, that show the positive effectiveness of sticking with people, changing people's lives, and changing where government is spending its money. Our effectiveness must be judged first and foremost on the ability of service staff like Julie to get people off the streets into homes of their own. This graph is based on 3 interviews with participants 9 months apart and shows a significant increase in the number of days people are living in their own home and a reduction in their time on the streets, in shelters, in institutions, doubled up with others, or in transitional housing programs. The interviews began more than a year after the first participants were enrolled, so the baseline data includes some people who had already been housed by pilot teams. The research shows a 36% reduction in the number of days people used illegal drugs or alcohol to intoxication, and a marked decrease in participants' experiences of mental health symptoms equivalent to having one less symptom a day, like racing thoughts or hearing voices. This graph shows the percentage of participants who are doing well in terms of stable housing, mental health, and chemical health at each of 3 time points. Over the 18-month period, we see significant gains across all 3. Supportive housing improves behavioral health. Now to the cost study. The researchers work with state agencies and counties to integrate data from many different systems to understand the cost of homelessness and the impact of people moving into supportive housing. The cost we were able to include came from 15 different data systems covering DHS healthcare programs, including both medical and behavioral healthcare, DHS income support programs, child welfare and out-of-home placements, as well as jails and prisons. This is a conservative, that is to say, underestimate of mainstream costs because there were things that we were not able to include, either because there was not a system for capturing the data at an individual level, like uncompensated healthcare, homeless shelters, courts, and cops, or the data is off limits for confidentiality reasons, like juvenile justice, things that we know are happening when people are homeless. Of the 748 people in the pilot, the researchers looked at data on 518 participants enrolled during the study period. They also looked at 20,000 other Minnesotans who had indicators of homelessness in their data. They identified 518 people who most looked like the pilot participants in their demographics and use of services during the 2 years before our participants enrolled in the pilot. That became the comparison group. This chart shows the annual cost to government during the period prior to participants' enrollment in the pilot, while they were still homeless. Government is spending, conservatively, $14,000 per year for every homeless single adult, and over $11,000 per year for each homeless family. But the research shows that spending is happening by and large in the most costly crisis in institutional settings. We know from the status of participants when we first met them that all this spending was not yielding good outcomes. Of note, government was incurring costs for all but 3% of participants while they were homeless. Homelessness looks poor, but it's very costly. Now this graph shows both the comparison group and the pilot group for the 2 years before participants enrolled and the 2 years after enrolling. We see the cost of mainstream services go up about the same for both groups. That's where the comparison group comes in handy. Now, this is a pretty gnarly graph. What it shows is by subgroups of single adults, adults and families, and children, the difference in spending by category between the pilot group and the comparison group. If a bar is above the line, pilot participants cost more. If a bar is below the line, participants cost less. Things on the left, where the pilot costs less, are the things you least want to spend money on, like prisons and psychiatric inpatients. Things on the right, where the pilot costs more, are where you most want to invest to get better outcomes, doctors, psychiatrists, and medicine. More simply put, we can separate bad costs, like prisons, inpatients, and detox, from good costs, like medicine and going to the doctor. This helps us see the dramatic shift for pilot participants away from bad costs below the line towards the things above the line that are more likely to yield improved outcomes for participants and for society. I wish I could say to you today that this program is so amazing that it creates instantaneous savings that more than cover the cost of the intervention. But you know it's more complicated than that. As we've learned in healthcare, it takes time to have good care reduce costs. Some of the places where we are saving money, like prisons, don't translate to a fiscal note in health and human services. When you look at a 2-year pre-post period, because that's the window of your budgeting, and frankly, we didn't think that you would invest in a 15-year demonstration project. But it's not a stretch to say that over time, not only will we continue to see improvements in people's lives, like Jim, but we'll also see cost reductions. And what if we break the intergenerational cycle of homelessness? I think the story of the pilot comes down to this. When people with long histories of homelessness are given the choice of supportive housing, they take it. When people have a home, they start to deal with other problems in their life. For some participants, the pilot saves their life. We're accomplishing with the most vulnerable, the most alienated group of Minnesotans, the urgent goals of health care reform, mental health reform, and corrections reform. Getting people out of prisons, hospitals, and emergency rooms, and into their own homes with more effective community-based support. We now have the data to prove that if you choose to leave people sleeping in tents or on shelter floors, government will still spend lots of money as people without homes use the ER, prisons, and hospitals. We can now say conclusively that supportive housing is a better government investment that works better for people who are trapped in homelessness. Thank you for your time and attention. We'd be more than happy to take any questions.
Questions, members? I did have one of the things that we had talked about was the difficulties about gaining the data and how our systems are set up. Do you want to just talk briefly about that?
You know, we actually brought a picture of that. If you can get that up, is that possible? One of the reasons it took so long to do this evaluation is that we wanted to integrate data from a bunch of different systems. Now, this is, I know you can't read this slide, but this is a picture of the healthcare system. And the healthcare system has three different levels of government, federal, state, and local. And then it's got a whole bunch of different programs. And then each of those programs are administered by different entities, and they all use different data systems to collect their data. So if you can see that blur of lines in the bottom right-hand corner, kind of the spaghetti on the bottom, that's what we had to disentangle to be able to figure out where people's data were in the state system. I tell you, the state data systems are not set up to track what happens to people. And this is just the health care. We've got other deconstruction of government data for other areas, too, like corrections and jail.
And I hope we do have some more time at some point to go through that, because as we move towards more outcomes and, you know, performance-based, this is, you know, one of the key problems that we have. Representative Huntley, did you have something?
I was going to save it for later, but it's just a comment, and
This is one of the few groups that's actually measured what they do, and actually it's the Robert Wood Johnson that's paid for that measurement. And we fund lots of things around here that we think are good projects, this one we actually know what their results are, and that's pretty unusual in the business that we're in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree with Representative Huntley. I think that this is one of the few groups that actually come to us each and every year with outcome measurements that are results driven. And I'm not saying that because I used to work for them. I'm just saying because I really believe in what they do. I do have a question. Just one question. We did the pilot study on a rural in an urban model. Can you talk a little bit about that, Jennifer, about the difference, if there was any discernible difference on what that looked like, homelessness in the kind of urban core versus the rural areas?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden. We did do this pilot in Ramsey County and Blue Earth County on purpose because we wanted to understand homelessness, not only, I think, as an urban phenomenon that a lot of people have in their minds, but also to understand what it looks like in a hub in a rural community like Mankato. And, you know, one of the things that I think surprised people was how many people there were in a rural community like Mankato who actually had been homeless for a long time. I think we also did a program with single adults and families, and I think a lot of people didn't believe at the very beginning that there were families in Minnesota who had been homeless for a long time. So I think we really helped our communities better understand what homelessness looks like, especially when it's deep in the woods or out in some building that people think is abandoned. In terms of the research and the data, what we know for families and single adults is that single adults come into the program with a higher level of barriers, a greater number of barriers than families do, but families have many barriers too, and they both make improvements, kind of on parallel trajectories. So families, you know, do better, singles, or families do better, and singles do better on a parallel path. Similarly, when we compare the characteristics of people who are homeless in St. Paul to those who are homeless in Mankato, those in St. Paul may have a greater number of barriers, but those in Mankato certainly have many, and that you see, again, improvements in both communities on parallel trajectories. I think that we don't have as much breakdown in terms of the cost data to understand the differences there, but I think that we know enough about the cost of our services in general that we have a similar situation there, where people who are in the city, the urban center, that maybe cost more, but we see trends that are similar between the urban and the rural communities.
President Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the testifiers, this might be, I'm thinking about the approach you've taken dealing with the population that is homeless. And I'm wondering if there's anything that we can learn from this when I think about a different population. So a population of people that are cared for under general assistance medical care. As I look at some of the data here, there's a lot of overlap, right? So this may be just too random a question, but I'm wondering if there's translational learning from what you've learned here when we think about that population, if you have advice for the committee at all on that point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, a couple things. Absolutely, there's tons of overlap here. I mean, the reason that homelessness costs our system so much is that it's kind of the where everything falls out. So our programs like general assistance and general assistance medical care, uncompensated care programs, out-of-home placement of kids and child welfare, all of that happens in homelessness. You know? I think that one of the things that we've learned uniquely in this supportive housing program, compared to some other research that's happened around the country, is that even when you look at a population that's rural and urban and families and singles, you still have people who have been tapping into lots of government programs, but they're not working for them. There's something that the programs are failing people most in need and the people who are the most vulnerable. So I think for us the next question is not how do we build, well, we would like to build a network of supportive housing so that no Minnesotan sleeps outdoors. Believe me, we would like to do that next. But I think the question is, what's wrong with our systems that people are becoming homeless in the first place, and when they are homeless, that they're remaining homeless for years and years and years? Because isn't that exactly what our safety net programs are supposed to be able to do? And why can't they do it for a significant portion of our population? So, I mean, I think that that's the challenge. But it means looking at this not as a homeless problem or a homeless program. It means looking at it as a health and human services and welfare and community problem. It's not something on the margins. This kind of goes to the heart of what's making the state budget, you know, hemorrhage. We've got log jams in emergency rooms because we don't have inpatient beds, and we have inpatient beds because we don't have enough community-based beds, and we've got people, you know, a huge portion, 25% of the men in prison are on psychiatric medications. I mean, so it's that part that's broken, and we have to look at it as health care reform and mental health reform, not as a homeless problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, thank you, and we're going to move on, but thank you very much for all this work, and I just had, we did have one last question, and, you know, one of the challenges that we have in a lot of these things is taking things like this to scale. You know, we kind of prove their success in a sense, but then leave them behind. But one of the comments you made when we met that I think about just about every day, and I, because you convinced me of it, was that we, you know, spending a couple tens of millions of dollars, not a couple, but six or seven tens, you know, $60 or $70 million, we could actually end homelessness in Minnesota, which I think would be marvelous, and is not, doesn't strike, I mean, maybe this year is a lot of money, but in general is not a particular money to achieve a pretty fundamental goal. And I just wanted to, if you wanted to just kind of end with something along those lines.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your bringing that up. You know, when we first started talking to the legislature about the pilot, it was a hypothesis. We thought maybe we could reach the people with the longest histories of homelessness. Maybe we could house them. And maybe if they were housed, we could help them do other better in other parts of their lives. And if they were doing better in other parts of their lives, maybe it would be a more productive use of scarce government resources. All those things turned out to be true. So it's easy to do that in a pilot. Anybody can do that for 150 households. You know, everybody's looking and taking good care. But then we were able to replicate it with the state regional long-term homeless project. We were able to see that what we were doing in Mankato, we could do in Rochester, we could do in Hibbing in Virginia, and what we were doing in St. Paul, God forbid, we could even do in Minneapolis. And so the ability to take something that works on a small scale, we've now shown that we can actually do it on a medium scale. So this is scalable, and we're finding the exact same results for people over and over again. And so, yeah, I appreciated that conversation with you, because I think it's not out of some type of ideology that I believe that it's possible to end long-term homelessness in Minnesota. It's because I've seen it happen to Jim and so many people like Jim all over the state, and I'm looking at the data, and it's showing that it works, and it works over and over and over again. So I'm convinced, and you're going to spend the money anyway, so you might as well spend it on something that gets a good outcome as opposed to spending it on something that's just jamming up our system.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much
thank
for coming down
much,
today. This is great. Oh, yeah, and while Representative Norton is going to the table, we will move the minute. Representative Lane, would you move the minutes for March 24th, 25th, and 26th?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any questions from members? All right, seeing none, all in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1276, which is a county mandate reduction bill.
Another bill to untangle the lockdown, huh?
Oh. I'll do my best. And I'm not certain where you would like to move this to.
To finance.
Finance. Okay, members, I'm going to need your patience. This.
Do you want to do this?
Yes, and that's, I need to move two amendments, and I think they're the, I want to say A.
A1 and A2.
A1 and A2. Oh, they're both here. And then after they're moved, we'll just talk about the bill as a whole. And
perfect.
I'll walk through it. Okay.
All right, Representative Norton moves the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion adopt. Motion prevails. Representative Norton moves the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Okay.
Thank you, members. And I need to apologize. This was a bill that's been heard through the Senate. Changes were made in the Senate, and changes continue to be made almost momentarily. moment by moment. So I've done the best I can. I'm going to take you through each article, but just the sections. If you have questions, there are people in the audience here that can address all the sections. Because I'm not an expert, this is a bill that has both health and human services changes in a whole variety of areas, so there's not a theme other than county. The first section is some changes in the availability of residential treatment services. The change states that placements can be made in across state borders if it is closest to the individual's home, and that's Section 1 and 2 does that. Section 3 discusses emergency admissions, and it's just a tiny change that the termination, level of care determination needs to happen in 5 working days instead of 3. Section 4 is one of the amendments, A2, and it's on cremation and funeral services. As I understand it, the counties have not been allowed to do cremations, and so this is going to allow cremations to be done for individuals if it does not violate their personal or family preferences. And again, I do have, as questions come, I have people here to discuss each of these. The next section is Section 5, and it is similar to the first section in the bill, which is about using residential services in a bordering state if approved by the state. That's also Section 6. Section 7 removes some language about family services collaborative and then renumbers. Section 8 adds a definition of licensor.
Right now. We have a question.
Okay.
Representative Tom.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Back to the cremation question.
Mm-hmm.
How will the... I know that in the Ramsey County and Hennepin County, it's very diverse. Does the county... What kind of mechanism do they determine whether cremation is appropriate for that community?
Representative Norton.
We have a speaker, Steve Carlson, who will address that.
Mr. Carlson. Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director with Minnesota Intercounty Association that represents 13 larger counties in the state, not, however, Ramsey County. With regards to your question, Representative Powell, the bill provides that if the spouse or next of kin expresses a preference due to either the decedent's or their own moral religious beliefs to have a traditional funeral with a burial done, that is what the county will do. So it intends to remain respectful of specific religious or ethnic beliefs where cremation may not be appropriate, but in those instances where it does not, there is not death hindrance, then cremation will be used for the disposition of the remains of the deceased.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, in the case you cannot contact the next of kin, do you guys have some kind of criteria to help determine whether cremation or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Powell, the agency, if they are knowledgeable that for a specific ethnic community that cremation is not in concert with the desires of that community, they would be free to elect a more traditional funeral with their burial if that circumstance exists.
Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Norton. I was going to ask along the same line. I was going to let you finish, however, but since we're on it now, and Mr. Carlson, I have really some concerns along the same lines, but mine kind of go the other way, and that is, I guess I'd kind of like to ask, and maybe like to ask counsel about this, perhaps about the constitutionality of this, because, you know, we're spending state money here, taxpayer funds, and to say that if somebody expresses a religious reason why they need more, that we would then pay more presumably to pay for another kind of funeral. And, you know, what about the person who comes in and the wife that comes in and says, you know, my husband wouldn't have liked this, as opposed to the person who says, oh, I have a moral reason why this isn't good enough for me. I mean, you know, I think we might be getting into a situation here where government is trying to decide on the validity of people's religious reasons, and that makes me uncomfortable. So I guess I'd like to ask you, Mr. Carlson, and then maybe we could ask the staff whether they have any thoughts on this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, you know, ultimately there's going to have to be some exercise of common sense right now. There is not going to be an interrogation of the spouse or the next of kin as to the basis of their beliefs or religion with regard to cremation versus burial. If the individual spouse or next of kin indicates that they prefer a traditional burial, that will be honored within the available dollars that the county will put towards it. They do cap, and I believe the amendment captures this explicitly, but that is actually the practice in several counties right now. They say this is what we will spend if burial can be done, and there are certainly vendors within the communities that will do a traditional burial within those capped amounts than the wishes of the spouse or next of kin, or as they were expressed in the decedent will be respected.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, I guess I that doesn't sound unreasonable to me. I mean, I think what I hear you sort of saying is that cremation is the default, and then if somebody comes in and says, no, I don't want that, or you have a real reason to believe they don't want that, then they get up to the limit of what you are going to be able to spend on a non-cremation funeral, but that's not what it says in the amendment, and I'm kind of uncomfortable. Could I ask, I don't know which staff person here would be.
Who's our constitutional lawyer? Okay. I'm just thinking of prison cases where people go to court and they can force the prison to spend more money to respect the crate, you know, meals that are in accordance with their religious beliefs and things like that.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, I think that might be different because when you're in custody, you're, you know, I think the state has more obligation toward you. This is a matter of spending more money because of your religious beliefs when you're not in custody, and it's kind of, you know, what does the state owe people? And so, any opinion?
I don't have an answer.
I believe it is capped in law, the maximum amount that they can pay. So, and the statute currently only allows the funeral expenses. What the counties are trying to do is have another option that will end up costing them that, probably. So it's not going to be anything more than what they've already been paying.
And we have another witness here who might. We do need to kind of move this along. So.
Sure. My name is Bill Jorgensen. I represent the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association. And originally, I think the intent of this bill was to offer cremation as a way that would be cost savings to the county. And typically, with 87 counties, you have 87 counties implementing this policy 87 different ways. And they currently pay for burial services, and they have a maximum amount that they pay for those. Basically, in this bill, we're just specifying that they can set that maximum amount, which they already do, and we're giving them permission to pay for cremation if a family chooses cremation, or if that individual doesn't have family. If the caseworker and the funeral director decide that it's okay for cremation, that person can go ahead and be cremated versus having to be buried.
Well, Mr. Chair, then I guess I'm really confused, because I thought Mr. Carlson was sort of saying that cremation was going to sort of be the default disposition, and that if there was a reason expressed up to the amount of the cap to do it the other way, that could be done. And if my understanding was correct, Mr. Carlson, then maybe we just need to play with the language a little bit to make it more clear and to take the religious piece out of it, because that kind of bothers me. Could you respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I am not adverse to taking out the reference to the religious beliefs of the decedent. We were just trying to be respectful of the motives of the spouse next of kin or the decedent himself, him or herself, if they expressed a preference prior to their death. And we're trying to identify the basis of that. It's probably not necessary to honor those concerns.
Sure, thank you. Well, maybe, I don't know, we're going to finance next on this, and I guess if my concern is kind of not altering your what your bill is here, maybe I can just work with Representative Norton later on to change the language, and then we don't have to do any more here today.
Representative Lanza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we continue to have people research this, I think the issue of indigent deaths, which I think are addressed somewhere else in the statute, but I might be wrong, where there's just nobody to take possession of the body, I think it's typically handled by a medical examiner who are actually much more skilled in investigating and finding next of kin and stuff. I'm just not sure if this doesn't create a new obligation for county staff to try and track down next of kin, where before it was just a benefit for which they were eligible and the family could ask for that to be applied. Now all of a sudden we're putting a responsibility for a county caseworker to suddenly become an investigator tracking down genealogy on someone, and I'm not sure that that's a reasonable expectation unless we add it into our very long application form. I just think this one needs some more thought.
I think Representative Norton will take all that under advisement.
I certainly will. And if you look on the original bill before it was amended, the counties have an obligation to contact, according to religious and moral beliefs in current law, and contact the descendants next of kin. So we're not changing either of those components. So if there is considerable concern, we could make the changes as we move forward. They were part of the original bill. They continue to be part of this new bill, just with the addition of cremation. So I will certainly work with any of you if you'd like to talk with me later between now and its next stop.
Okay. I think we're on Section 6.
We're on Article 2, health care, I believe.
Oh, I'm sorry, we're beyond that. I don't want to slow you down. Okay. Article 2, yes, thank you.
There was a small change made on line 8.3 as a result of one of the amendments. In working with the health plans, after the word audit, it says including standards and audit practices. That was added. You move down to Section 2 of the healthcare section, and that whole part was cut out, and what we put in was the bill that you approved in this committee, it was incontinent residents and resident positioning, the Jen McNerney, who many of you know from the bill that I had, but Representative Houston carried for me, and that we just inserted that language. So we took out what was currently in there and replaced what we had already approved in this committee. Section 4 has a minor change to it. Does not require new nursing supervision, and then it has some day training and rehabilitation added on page 10, line 20. Section 6 makes some changes, and I know one of you have already contacted me, that adds the term charter schools to the current legislation and then removes the sections that mandate that schools, after a child has been determined for free and reduced lunch, that the district will provide the child particular information, but left in the sections that said the school district will provide all children with information about health care programs and access to applications, but it removes the specific language that said they were targeting free and reduced lunch.
And just on that, tomorrow we're going to be having a bill that kind of goes exactly the other direction on that, so just so everybody knows that, but in a different way than we do in current law. I think current law is not working. I agree with you on that.
And it does have a stipulation that's putting on the information will be on the website, so all parents that have access to internet will be able to find that information. Section 7 is a bill that was already heard in this committee. John Ward, I believe, had this bill, and it's already passed through this committee.
Mm-hmm.
Section 8 was completely...
I thought I'd seen that.
You did?
Okay, there we go.
So it's been heard. Section 8, it was completely deleting. And Section 9 was actually Tom Anzell's bill that has not been heard, but I do have someone here that would speak to it from the International Union of Operators, Engineer Local 49. Mike Wild?
Welcome to the committee.
Chairman, Representatives, the Section 9 referred to is merely a clarification that allows the status quo.
Could you just state your name for the record? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. My name is Mike Wild. I'm the attorney for Operating Engineers Local 49. And the proposed bill is merely for clarification purposes to allow public employers to continue to contribute to self-funded multi-employer health and welfare plans as they have for 25 to 30 years in the state of Minnesota. An issue came up that raised concern for some public employers, and we thought this was necessary for purposes of clarification.
Okay. Any questions? Okay.
Thank you.
And the repealer?
I'm just looking for what section that repealed, and I'm sorry, I can't find my notes on that.
But is it related to another section of the bill?
Yes,
okay.
I believe it is. But I'm unable to.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, on page 8, it's the section of audits that allows an independent audit to be used. What my question is, it talks about performance standards. Are those financial performance standards, or are they kind of health care they're delivering, that sort of thing?
Representative Norton?
It's a section of current law, and I can't speak to that. And I looked at the county, the folks from MICA, and they are shaking their head that they don't know the answer to that either. We're not changing current law. So it would be whatever it was referring to in current law. And I'm sorry, I don't know that.
Okay, we'll find out.
I'll
go into your committee. So.
I'll have the answer by the time it gets to Representative Huntley's committee.
Any other questions, members? Representative Gallo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton, thanks for bringing this forward. I had just one question, and that's whether by establishing any of these rules or changing them, any chance we're putting many patients at risk of diminished care?
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the concern that some might have had was with a section that we took out, which was that Section 8. There might have been some discussion on that one because we were changing the 24-hour customized care from up to 12 and then up to 16.
Right?
Yes, and there ended up being some financial costs to it, so we did take it out of the bill completely because of the fiscal note.
Okay, good. Thank you.
But to my knowledge, that was the only concern that's been raised.
Any other questions? Well, thank you for your work on this, Representative Norton. Representative Norton renews her motion that House File 1276, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion say aye.
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 All opposed? Motion to prevail.
Thank you, Committee, and Mr. Chair.
Members, House File 249 was a bill included in Representative Powell's licensing bill. I'm not going to offer the amendment that was attached there as a delete all, but I would like to just move House File 249 onto the Finance Committee. So we've already heard the bill. All right. So if there's any discussion, all right. So I'd move that House File 249 be recommended passed and be referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you.
That should go on.
It will be. Representative Posh. They're going to get Representative Posh. So, I'll do an announcement, which is tomorrow we're going to actually start at 3:15 so that we can meet as caucuses, if you so choose. Well, you will choose. And then one of you guys. And then we'll fill the third season. Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for your time this afternoon, I believe it still is. House File 866 is...
I'll move it for you. That be recommended pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations?
Correct.
Okay. And do you want this amendment moved right now, too? Oh, no, that's later on. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I did have an amendment that did not meet the 24-hour deadline, but I wanted the committee to know that I'm willing to address some of the concerns and make changes as needed, and I'll be pursuing that amendment in the next committee.
Okay.
House File 866 is a statewide health insurance pool for school employees throughout the state of Minnesota. It would create an independent pool within PEEP, the Public Employees Insurance Program, that is essentially modeled after the state employee group insurance program that all of our state employees and legislators, if you choose to do so, participate in. It would create this pool in the interest of providing stability for many of our districts throughout the state of Minnesota with premiums. I think provide a pool in which we'll provide competitive rates for our employees and hopefully stabilize costs for our school districts everywhere. If you look at some of the data, in 2007, Minnesota saw an average of an 8.4% increase in premiums, and with CGIP, there was a 0% increase during that same time period. So it's those results that we're looking at trying to provide to all school districts, regardless of where they reside in the state of Minnesota. With that said, Mr. Chair, though, there's plenty of testifiers, and I would rather have them be able to address the committee. So,
all right, welcome to the committee. Please identify for yourself for the record and members.
Mr. Chair, my name is Russ Torkel, and I teach industrial technology at St. Clair Public School. Right now, it's a tough time. It's a tough choice for a lot of people for health care, but it's not a tough choice for me. It's just not an option. In our district, it costs for family coverage a little over $1,000 a month for health care coverage for my family. We're a small district, so we get hit unusually hard with premium increases because if one or two teachers have something happen, that cost has to get spread out through a smaller pool than a statewide pool would offer. Right now, my best option is to gamble. I gamble that something major doesn't happen to me, my wife, or most importantly, my two children. And it's cheaper for us to pay as we go. We made an arrangement with the clinic we attend to pay as we go, to pay $100 a month to them and continue to use services. We don't go to the emergency room and charge it up that way. We go in and see a doctor when we have problems with the earaches, the sore throats, and stuff like that. So it's a gamble for me right now. We have only 8 teachers left in our district that are on the plan out of 41 teachers that can still afford the plan, with the rate changes that have happened over the 9 years that I've been at St. Clair. I'm not here to ask for a handout. I'm here to ask for statewide coverage and a larger pool. I work 3 jobs. I work full-time in the summer. I'm not looking for a handout. I'm looking to pay my share, but at $1,000 a month, it's just not an option for me and many of my colleagues at St. Clair and a lot of smaller districts around the state. In the last 2 years, we've lost 2 wonderful teachers over just the health care benefit issue. Our Spanish teacher moved to, but it's cheaper for him to drive 45 minutes and get health care coverage at his current school than it was to stay in St. Clair and pay the $1,000 a month. And another teacher stuck it out for 13 years paying his premium to the school, but it just got too much for him and he moved on. We're taking the least costly measure right now for people at St. Clair. We're paying it on our own and hoping nothing catastrophic happens. I've been coming here for 4 years lobbying for this, and we just need to take a step. It may not be the greatest step, but it's a step. At least it's a step. That's what I'm asking for, to give us a bigger pool to keep these premium increases down to a minimum and provide us health care coverage for teachers. We all talk about valuing education, getting the best people into education.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard to get the best people into education when they're paying $1,000 a month for health care. It's just not realistic, in my opinion. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Alsweiger, Education Minnesota. And I think that our teacher has done an excellent job of outlining the problem. This is not just in St. Clair, it's across the state. It's not just a rural issue, it's a suburban issue, it's an urban issue as well. And we believe that providing a statewide mandatory pool for all school employees, just like the state employee pool has, would be helpful to our members. I want to call your attention to the letter that was drafted and presented to you by the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And actually, I kind of like this letter. Because if you look in the second paragraph, it says, the consensus among the conference experts was that simply creating a large pool is not the answer to getting health care costs under control. That is exactly why our bill does not just simply form a mandatory large pool. You look at the third paragraph, it says, that the conference presenters all emphasize that the only way to get costs under control is by controlling utilization through consumer education, implementing disease management and wellness programs, and providing incentives to use less costly services. So if you have a large pool and you put these provisions in, then you can start to control health care costs. Look at the bill on lines 1.10 through 1.13, and that is exactly what we are doing, what those conference presenters have said that you can start to do to control health care costs. In fact, it is exactly what CGIF is doing, a large statewide mandatory pool that is emphasizing education, disease management. When you hear testifiers in a moment talk about working hard to control costs, what working hard has meant to our members is some of these types of things, but the way that the premiums are being reduced most often is by reducing the benefits for our employees and increasing their co-pays for drugs, for office visits, and so on. You have heard our testimony over the years, and so I will leave that, and if you have any questions, we can certainly answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. First of all, Representative Posh, I appreciate you bringing this forward. I understand the spirit that this is being brought forward in. I'm not sure I agree with the bill entirely, but I do understand what you're trying to do. To the testifier, are there districts in the state that are already implementing health improvement programs and arguably doing a good job controlling their own health care costs?
Either the testifier.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, I don't have information on that. I just know in our district, with 8 people left, there's not much we can do to control costs.
And maybe there's other people that can, we'll be able to answer that. Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming down. Appreciate it. Representative Hodge, if you want to,
Well, I just wanted to respond to Representative Gottwald's question. I think we all know that, you know, trying to maintain costs and to increase health is an important component to maintaining and stabilizing costs in health care. However, when you have some districts, you know, further up north, even in Todd County, that don't have health insurance provided to their teachers, or when you have schools that are so small that those efforts, as well intended as they are, one event, one catastrophic event, can make a huge impact on costs, and that's the need that we have for this bill today.
Thank you. Why don't we touch them and make them pack up? Ms. Kelleher. Or someone from the School Boards Association if they wanted to testify. Or Mr. Brinkman. Or, if there's School Board Association that wants to testify, you're certainly welcome to come up. Okay. Go ahead. Welcome to the committee. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. My name is Paul Brankman. I'm with the Northeast Service Cooperative in Mountain Iron. During my testimony, please keep in mind that service cooperatives offer the longest-running, most cost-efficient model of shared services in the state of Minnesota. We are locally governed, widely regulated, and routinely audited. We have no authority to tax or to levy and receive no direct state appropriation. In fact, participation in a service cooperative is strictly voluntary as it currently stands. And in these tough times, if we can't help a member school district, our members can vote with their feet and move on. However, at 95% retention, member participation rates demonstrate our value in Minnesota. I'm here today in opposition of House File 866. In general, this proposed purchasing mandate offers nothing new to address the actual cost drivers in health care. It ignores a proven record of shared services through Minnesota Service Cooperatives, and it permanently shifts over $1 billion in risk from local governments, including service cooperatives, to the state of Minnesota. Let us review these three key issues. This new purchasing mandate offers nothing new to address the actual cost drivers in health care. Although pooling arrangements make a difference, and historically ours has worked well, this proposal offers no new solutions. In fact, it offers no details that would address the real cost drivers in health care. And we heard about some of them today. Utilization, plan design, premium contribution levels, and bad practices such as single plus one, unfunded liabilities, and cash in lieu. There's nothing in the bill to address these issues. In fact, if you read the bill closely and listen to the testimony of Education Minnesota, this legislation doesn't even require school districts to offer coverage. And it certainly doesn't require employees to take any offered coverage. The proposal does nothing to increase district contributions. In fact, that would help bring more teachers into the group. That was discussed. Some of the districts often mentioned don't even offer coverage, and they aren't required to do so under this bill. And the reason they don't offer coverage or adequate coverage is that their employee groups have agreed to their collective bargaining process, in some cases, to actually drop coverage. This new purchasing mandate also ignores the proven record of shared services through the Minnesota Service Cooperatives. In reality, the service cooperatives offer a proven record of successful shared services, all on a voluntary basis. Historically, we have been more cost-effective than CGIP and PEEP and other pooled programs when it comes to administrative costs, leaving more money for claims payments. In rural Minnesota, for example, many of our groups are small enough where they're not even rateable on their own, and they have limited resources at their disposal. Using standard underwriting guidelines and leveraging various local, regional, and state resources, we make it work. For example, over the past few years, teachers from 57 school districts have sought alternate quotes from PEEP. To date, not one has left us. Let me reiterate this point. Teachers, through their collective bargaining representatives, have the statutory right within Section 43A.316, Subdivision 5, to join PEEP without the consent of management of the school board. To date, none of the 57 groups seeking PEEP bids within our pools have left their current pooling arrangements. In fact, St. Paul teachers voted last fall 2-1 against joining PEEP. Finally, this new mandate permanently shifts over $1 billion in risk from local governments, including service cooperatives, to the state of Minnesota. As proposed, as we mentioned, the bill does not trump local collective bargaining, a Minnesota tradition that is highly valued by our member school districts. As a result, however, intended or not, local cost drivers will remain in place while new escalating costs and liabilities shift to a new layer of government to the state of Minnesota. As drafted, this proposal needs to be analyzed to determine what extent it puts Minnesota taxpayers further at risk, and what is the state's capacity to begin bailing out local school districts for unfunded liabilities such as other post-employment benefits. In short, House File 866 offers nothing new to address the actual cost drivers in health care. It ignores a proven record of shared services with the Minnesota Service Cooperative, and it permanently shifts over $1 billion in risk to the state of Minnesota. In contrast, today, service cooperatives administer competitive, voluntary, shared services arrangements that respond to the local needs of more than 600 schools, cities, counties, and other public agencies in the state of Minnesota. We appreciate your support in the past, and we look forward to working with you in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brinkman, if I could ask just for a moment, when we hear about school districts with five or six employees or the small groups that are crying out for coverage, do the service cooperatives offer that kind of coverage?
Mr. Brinkman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gottwald, yes. We're not about to claim that there are districts that may fall through the cracks, and occasionally we hear about them. Oftentimes, when I come down each session, it's always a district that's not under a service cooperative arrangement. And we've offered to work with these groups and go back to the beginning and figure out how we can make it work. But that requires labor and management to come to the table.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher. I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. The school boards represent all 342 school districts from around the state, and we're here to testify against this bill, members. We are concerned that our employees who presently aren't covered will not be picked up under this bill. Practices like cash and lieu, which have ended with employers paying for a significant share of employees' coverage, will continue. Retiree health care, which is really important, is not addressed in this bill, and we do have present statute that's not picked up. It's 471-6151 that we really need to transition to. As you read through this bill, you will find, as your local school districts look at it, if this was enacted the way it's stated, it would require us all to go to three health plans. Well, members, we probably have over 300 different plans offered around the state. The inherent difficulty of that is large. But when you're starting with a deficit or even the same funds you had the year before, steps and lanes cost about 3% right on top. Where we would find the money to negotiate this and to go up or somehow round to the three initial planned offerings is very unclear in this bill. I don't know how you would advise your school district to proceed to even get to three. We have questions whether this bill would enhance or decrease coverage for your local school district employees. This has always really been about winners in school districts from around the state of Minnesota. The losers would tend to be those school districts who were proactive, who did the right things with their employees and have controlled their health care costs. Lastly, we want to make sure that claims for our employees are paid day one and their coverage is assured, and that losses that this might inherently have do not pass back on to school districts as their local burden. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony. Forgive me for being late. Representative Dabney had a bill downstairs on concurrent enrollment that I was testifying on, Mr. Chairman. I apologize.
Not at all. Not a problem. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Spence? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. My name is Dennis Fent. I'm a longtime union member. I'm a longtime teacher union president. I'm a longtime teacher negotiator. I'm a longtime member of our district's insurance committee. Last but not least, I'm a school teacher since 1973, and I'm extremely proud of that. In all these years, I've tried to teach the students that I have had to use logic, to use appropriate information, to use best research practices, to use most reliable data. And I was impressed as I was sitting here earlier, because when I heard the discussion about the homelessness, I heard many of you talk about outcome-driven decisions. I heard you talk about research. I heard you talking about coming forth with real data. In fact, I heard the word repeated, data, data, data. And I'm fond of that word, and that's the reason I'm here today. I know the concepts of logic, appropriate information, best research practices, most reliable data would be concepts that each and every one of you would support. The problem today is the bill you are considering is totally void of these concepts. Today, I ask you to lead by example, and to do that, I would ask that you vote no on this bill. You cannot insist that our students employ state-of-the-art research techniques. You can't insist teachers implement data-driven decision-making, and at the same time, mandate an undefined, uncosted, nebulous bill upon educators across the state. Now, I know that leaves you with a dilemma, but there's an answer to your dilemma. There's an alternative to passing this bill. There is a bill presented in both the House and the Senate to study the outcomes, the costs, and all of the other needed data. It's available for you to vote on. I can't imagine that we would vote on a bill void of that information, that data, and at the same time not vote to support a bill that would allow you to collect exactly that same data. I thank you very much for your time, and again, I would encourage you to vote no on this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Bourgeois and Mr. Kastner, if you want to come down and sit at the table too, that would be great. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here representing Minnetonka Public Schools. We are a self-insured school district for health insurance.
And if you just state your name.
I'm sorry. Paul Bourgeois, the Executive Director of Finance and Operations for Minnetonka Public Schools.
Thank you.
The bill in front of you would mandate participation by all school districts, even those that have been very successful in maintaining health care costs over the past several decades, in spite of the increasing health care costs in the state and across the nation. I've had the opportunity to work at two school districts. I worked in the same position for Rochester Public Schools for 10 years, where we were self-insured, and at Minnetonka Public Schools. Also, I ran a large shared service self-insurance fund for a public power company in Wisconsin for 5 years in between those stints. In both of the school districts that I worked at, health insurance was managed collegially with management, with every bargaining unit at the table in a self-insurance commission, making sure that what was being offered was prudent and promoted the health of the employees at a reasonable cost. What we negotiated at the bargaining unit table were how much the district and how much each employee would contribute, but we would not be negotiating whether Botox or facelifts or any type of coverages would be included. We were able to keep that in a collegial manner at the insurance commission, as opposed to having it be done at the bargaining unit table. What that did was it made the health insurance plan our plan. It wasn't management's plan that we were responsible for taking care of. It was our plan, every employee, every participant, every retiree. These models are out there across the state. There are numerous school districts that have this very similar model that works very successfully. And it can be replicated. It can be replicated district by district. A state-mandated pool would raise our premiums probably in the multiple double digits. Our premiums increases in Minnetonka for the last 7 years. We instituted the fund in 2000, and the first 2 years we built up our reserve. But since 2002, we've seen increases of 3.87%, 3.37%, 0, 2.86, 3.5, 5, 3%, and for 2009-2010, we are going to have a 0% increase that's going in front of the board for approval on Tuesday, April 7th. We do this together. We do this both the bargaining units and the school board and the administration taking care of our plan. This can be done on a district-by-district basis. The plan is tailored for our district. It's tailored for our experience. We've had low low rates of increase, even in spite of having very difficult cancers, very difficult heart surgeries, car accidents, and things of that nature. So we have not just been lucky. It can be done. Mandating everybody to go into a pool, which is going to create winners and losers, is not the way to do it. It is possible for us to replicate this model. It is possible for all districts to be winners, and I'd like you to consider this information as you consider this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Kastner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. I am Todd Kastner. I'm a teacher at Stillwater High School. And as Paul just said, from Minnetonka, Stillwater also is a school that we have worked hard in our insurance committee with our district, with other bargaining groups to keep our insurance costs down in the district and have a very good policy in comparison to other districts. I also am speaking against this bill because there is nothing to ensure that it's not going to harm us, Minnetonka, North St. Paul, other districts. There's going to be winners and losers with this bill from the way we see it. And there should be, and I would also argue that we should get the data, pass the bills that are in the House and the Senate, get data to find out ways to make sure that there are not winners and losers when this happens. It is unfortunate that there are districts that don't have insurance, and our district would certainly support something that does not cost our district, doesn't cost employees at our district and hurt students or take away money from students at our district. So, you know, we're not opposed to statewide health as just a general concept, but there needs to be things that are done to make sure that it does not harm districts or cost districts money. Because as you know, most of the districts are hurting financially right now, and to put on a statewide health insurance mandate that would increase that financial pain, I don't think would be prudent. And this bill, as it's written, does not make sure that doesn't happen. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you. Mr. Griffin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I know I'm on the list and told the committee administrator that I was speaking on behalf of Preferred One, but I have since spoken with my colleagues, and I am speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans today. Mr. Chairman, members, we are opposed to the passage of Representative Hosh's bill. We appreciate the opportunity to talk with him, and I think you've heard most of the arguments that we would make to you, but I want to emphasize them. Mr. Chairman, you had a question?
Oh,
I'm sorry.
There's going to be a question from Ms. Dalsberger later, I think.
So okay.
Just don't go too far.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, members. But I do want to bring back just a couple of issues that I know we've discussed before when this bill has been in front of the committee in past years, and just brush them off for you again. As you know, this bill would put these teachers into a PEAK system. There are concerns about that from a regulatory standpoint. There are exemptions in this bill that would take them out of paying current assessments, current licensure fees, current surcharges, and most importantly, the MCHA assessment. Mr. Johansson and I have talked about those in the past. They would like to pay those on a proportional basis. I would love to be able to pay those on a proportional basis, but we as health plans are not allowed to do that in the state. This bill removes those companies that are currently in the insured market, and as you know, state regulators and policymakers can only reach 27% of our market due to the shrinking nature of that market by more and more groups going self-insured. Mr. Chairman and members, under this proposal, there are approximately 200,000 lives in 341 districts that generate about $1 billion worth of claims that are going into this system. This needs to be well-funded to cover the liabilities of those claims. And it's not something that you should do casually by just setting up a pool. The reasons that we have reserves in this state for health plans goes back to 1988, when we saw health plans hovering on the brink of insolvency. We saw one health plan that was absorbed by another health plan, but since we've had consolidation in the market, should that happen again today, there are not sufficient funds within the other plans to absorb one that's going bankrupt. And, Mr. Chairman, that's not something that I say lightly. It's not a threat to the committee. It is strictly the reality. Mr. Chairman, members, this also is something that you need to look at very closely to make sure that all the mandates that you do pass apply to this kind of a system. Last but not least, you've heard it from many of the other members, and I will reiterate what I've said before this committee before in talking about mandates that you've had before you. The underlying costs in healthcare really are due to utilization and increases in the wonderful technologies that we all want to make sure that people have access to. But this bill does nothing to stop the increase in utilization, to change the negotiated rates that we have with providers, to influence technology, to bring inefficiencies out of the system, to deal with an aging population, or to fix the lifestyle choices that people are making that are driving healthcare costs up. This proposal merely shifts money around within the system and therefore does not save money in the long run. Mr. Chairman and members, we would like to make sure that if a bill like this moves forward, it meets the same insolvency standards and protections that we have in current law, that it includes all consumer protections afforded to all other Minnesotans, including the complaint process procedures that we're required to operate under as health plans. We'd like to have it provide the same levels of benefits and mandates required by fully insured products that the Commerce and Health Department regulates. We'd like to have this pay the full assessments of all of the insurance taxes, premiums, insurance taxes and assessments that we have. And finally, we'd like to make it subject to the approval of the Commerce Department as our all of our proposals. Mr. Chairman, members, I've gone on long enough that you've heard a great deal of this. We understand the need that teachers have to have education taken as seriously and the health care benefits that they have as educators taken as seriously. This bill does not do that. As you've heard my predecessors say, the bill doesn't make sure that everyone has health care who works for a school district and doesn't require those districts to offer coverage to those people. Mr. Chairman, members, if there are other questions related to my testimony, I'd be happy to take
them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Griffin, we keep hearing about small districts that don't have access to coverage, that are uncovered, that have small numbers of employees. Are there products being offered through members of your organization and others that provide, that offer coverage that could be accessible by these districts?
Mr. Griffin.
Mr. Chairman, we are offering coverage, and we'd be happy to work with school districts to do it. I'm afraid that in some of those districts where they've made choices of not requiring people to stay in the group, and you heard about one of those groups already from one of the proponents of the bill, the adverse selection that they've received has made it very, very difficult for them to get back into the insured market. Should we fix that problem, Mr. Chairman and members? Absolutely, I think that problem needs to be fixed. But I don't think tearing apart the system that we have, that a lot of districts have put a lot of time and effort into fixing, is necessarily the way to go. If we are out there, there is an individual marketplace for those people. It's very expensive. I'm in it. But Mr. Chairman and members, those are choices that have been made in the past, and it's going to be very difficult to fix them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Member.
Representative Norton, if you want to...
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment to the A-12.
Representative Norton offers the A-12 amendment. Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to repeat anything that's been said. I've said in the past couple of years that my school district is one of those self-insurers, as Mr. Bourgeois talked about. We have a very similar 0.03% type increases. We're doing very well, and we think we come out on a really bad end with this. So I'm... asking that this amendment be put on. It will allow school districts that have that are self-insured, either individually as a self-insured group, not be included in the term self-employer.
Okay. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton, I appreciate the amendment, but I would oppose the amendment at this time. What we are trying to do here with the bill is to create a self-insured pool. That will bring stability for health insurance costs and premiums throughout the state of Minnesota, regardless of where you're from. I want to address a few of the claims because there's talk about data and that we had to include data and facts and information of that matter.
Can we stick with the amendment first? If it goes to the amendment, that's fine.
It goes to the amendment, Mr. Chair. Such plans, we heard from the co-ops today and others that are self-insured about trying to provide that same stability. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of our school districts are seeing instability even with self-insured plans. Pine River Bath has 54% increase in their health insurance plans. The testifier earlier today, the teacher, Mr. Torkola, their plan was also a cooperative plan, and they would be exempted from this. It does not solve the problems that we're trying to address. So I appreciate the amendment, Representative Norton, but this is something I cannot support at this time.
Representative Lawson. Is this the amendment?
No.
Okay.
This is the statute amendment. Although I would...
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the amendment. Representative Norton, I was reading this amendment, and I just wonder if the way it's drafted, maybe I haven't had enough time to really read how it fits into the bill, but it seems to me that it would not allow any of the districts that are described in the amendment to join, even if they wanted to. So that kind of troubles me. Can you address that?
It does exclude groups that are individually or as part of a self-insurance group from health coverage. They could choose not to be self-insured and join this group if they so chose.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's not how I read it. I read it as saying that if they have the self-insurance, that they are not under the definition of anybody who could be in this bill. So,
Reverend Norton?
That is true. That's what it said, and they would have to move to be self-insured, and then they could apply.
They could choose not to be self-insured and apply. Okay. Seeing no further discussion on the amendment, all in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
The motion does not prevail. Vision the call, all the yeses, raise your hand. And raise them high, please, so we know for sure. All the noes, raise your hand. And denying the motion prevails. President Brooks.
I just had a question for Representative Hosh related to charter schools and whether this bill pulls the charter schools into the system. And then also, if so, what representation do they have on this insurance committee?
Representative Hosh. Mr. Chair, Representative Brooks, at this time, charter schools would not be included in this poll. If that's something that you're interested in addressing, I would be happy to have those discussions with you.
Representative
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hosh, the reason I asked is I was reading Section 128.05, and Section 128.05 talks about special districts. It means a district established by a charter granted by the legislature, a home rule charter. So is that not a charter school, or is that a different type of charter? I'm just confused at what that language actually means.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I don't have that statute reference in front of me, so I will have to look into that. But at this point, charter schools are not included under this proposal for the statewide health insurance plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I wasn't real familiar with how PEEP has evolved over the years, so I went to the website, and I have to say that I couldn't find everything on the website, but I think if we're in a debate mandating all of our school district employees, from the lunchroom lady up to the superintendent, to be in this program, we should know something about what it is and what the benefit coverages are, and I didn't hear any testimony to that effect. I couldn't find the premium levels because I suspect that those are bid based on the rate, the age, the demographics, the health status, claims experience of the group. That's very typical. But I was able to find the description of the benefit coverage of these three different plans that we mandate to be available. And I think we should weigh that carefully. The top plan, which is called the Advantage Health Plan, beyond your premiums, has a variety of cost sharing for, you know, that varies by whether it's single or family coverage for various visits and stuff. But I thought you should know that the maximum out-of-pocket, and there are four cost levels for each of these three plans, varies from $1,900 to $3,800 at the lowest level cost plan at the top. This is the Advantage Health Plan, the top one. And so a family, in addition to paying its premiums, paying up to 25% co-insurance and 30% on some other things and $30 or more per visit, would also be responsible for the first $1,900 in a single policy or $3,800 on a family policy. The middle level tier, which is called the value option, in addition to their monthly premiums, which I don't have any information about, a single person would have a maximum out-of-pocket expense of $3,000 a year, and a family of $6,000 a year. That could be $500 a month if you have any kind of catastrophic health issue, which, you know, could be just a broken leg. The bottom level coverage is their high-deductible health plan. And that provides at all of their cost levels a out-of-pocket maximum of $5,000 for a single person and $10,000 for a family. And the 20% of the co-insurance, after you've met your deductible under this high-deductible plan, you've paid your premiums, you've paid your $5,000 or $10,000 as a deductible. After the deductible is applied, you still pay 20% or 40% additional of all costs past that $5,000 or $10,000. And I grew up in a labor household. Our family endured strikes. I understand the value of banding together to get something collectively that you couldn't get individually. But I think the purpose of banding together is always to get something better than you could individually. It's always about making sure that what you get is quality. And if we're going to mandate participation in something, I think we ought to make sure it's mandating participation in a quality product. And quite honestly, I don't think mandating a lunchroom lady into a teacher into a program that has potentially a $5,000 to $10,000 deductible plus 20% to 40% beyond that plus premium is any better than the products that I've been hearing people describe. And I am as committed as anyone around this table at trying to find a solution to affordable health coverage for all Minnesota employees, whether they work for a school district, they work for a city, they work for a private employer. But I would really like to say, as a health policy committee, we should weigh in on the product offerings. And I would like to recommend that at a minimum we take the middle and worst offerings off the table, because I do believe that our school district employees, whether you're in a school district that likes the current plan or not, will be very unhappy with us if they are mandated into a plan that potentially offers them this huge cost sharing. And we have heard from the hospitals, we have heard from the doctors about the problems they're having when families just can't come up with those kind of deductibles. So if the committee would indulge me, I would like to move on line 3.3 to delete Advantage Value and Advantage HSA plans.
I think that's a substantive amendment. I don't think we're going to, it didn't meet the 24-hour rule, so we're not going to allow that one to go. Representative Hott, you're going to get a last word, and then we're going to go to a vote.
Okay. Mr. Chair, a few things I would like to address. First, you know, with some of the out-of-pocket expenses and the co-insurance, our current plans pay 100% insurance costs on many, many things that you wouldn't have that out-of-pocket expense, such as labs, pathology, x-rays, certain other expenses like home health aids and home health care. A few things I do want to address. Some of the concerns that this doesn't address health care costs. You know, if we would have amended this to our health care reform bill from 2 years ago, I think there would have been some opposition at the same time. We're addressing health care costs as a legislature through reforms. That's going to affect all plans throughout the state of Minnesota. The statewide health plan, if we pass this, and other independent self-insured plans. So I think costs are being addressed outside of this bill. Some of the concerns that, you know, that some of the self-insured plans are doing well and that they've been able to stabilize costs, that's very reflective of what we've been able to do in the state of Minnesota. And the school districts such as Minnetonka that have 2,300 lives under their plans is a luxury for them. For a lot of our school districts, they do not have that luxury. And they need some option, and a statewide plan is going to allow them some of that stability. We talked about some facts and the need for data. I tried to do the best I could when it comes to data. try to do some research. And for the last 3 years, in 2006, the average premium increase was 7.4%.
We have about a minute, okay.
8.4% in 2007 and 9% in 2008. Our state plan drastically outperformed those trends. Also, it's important, I've been trying to do some research on what the premium costs. And St. Paul was the only school district that got back to me. I tried to contact Minnetonka to do a comparison, but they haven't returned my calls. But the St. Paul School District is paying $600 a month more than what the premium cost under CGIP currently provides to state employees. This is a good plan for our schools. It brings the stability that we need throughout all of Minnesota. I will definitely take concerns into consideration and work on trying to make the bill better, but I would appreciate the committee support.
Okay. I will renew my motion that House File 866 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the State and Local Government Operations Committee. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Division has been requested. Everybody who voted yes, please raise your hand. Aye. And everybody that voted no, please raise your hands. Twelve to eight, the motion prevails. And we are adjourned.